Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall, and this is the Downtime Podcast, where I take you behind the scenes of downhill and enduro mountain biking. Things are changing fast around the globe at the moment, and I hope you're all managing to stay safe. Please, please follow the rules in your area. If you're supposed to be locked down or distancing, then just do it. Every day that people don't follow the rules is another day that we aren't getting this under control, and we're all going to suffer as a result. If you are able to ride, then definitely do it, as it's good for the soul, but just be safe and sensible, as the emergency services are overrun and don't need us adding to their challenges. As long as I can remain healthy, I'm going to keep bringing you the podcast, as there's some quality mountain bike related entertainment for you every week. This episode of the podcast is supported by We Are One Composites. These guys are manufacturing awesome carbon wheels and a bar and stem combo called The Package in Kamloops in Canada. I've been on their wheels for 2 years now and I love them. They are the best feeling wheels I've ever ridden and the only set of wheels that I've ever owned that hasn't needed any maintenance. As a Downtime listener, you're being kindly offered 15% off until 30th of April. All you need to do is to head to wearonecomposites.com and use the code HANDLAID2020 at the checkout. That's HANDLAID2020, all in lowercase. That's over on wearonecomposites.com. So if you want to get your hands on the best carbon wheels available at a bargain price, then you know what to do. To make sure you get your weekly fix of the podcast, then head to downtimepodcast.com/subscribe. There's links there that will help you subscribe on whatever platform is best for you. While you're at it, you should join our newsletter to receive our weekly weekend warm-up email for a few bits of interesting bike-related stuff coming to your inbox on a Friday. You can do that on the same page. You can also help support the podcast and keep it growing and improving in a few different ways. You can head to downtimepodcast.com/shop and make a financial contribution by clicking on Share the Love. You can get hold of some of our awesome t-shirts, sweatshirts, hoodies and mugs. Or if that's not right for you, then please just keep on spreading the word and making sure all your riding mates are listening to the podcast. Don't forget to give us a follow on social media as well, where we're at Downtime Podcast. Okay, this week on the show, I'm chatting with Dakota Norton. Dakota has worked super hard to climb the ranks of the sport, where he now competes at the top level. Taking a fifth place at Lozenge in 2018 really showed what he's capable of. After a rough 2019 season, Dakota is back on form and ready to go. We chat about his childhood riding motocross, his time competing in BMX, and how he eventually found mountain biking. Chatting to Dakota really makes you realise what you can achieve if you're focused and willing to put in the effort and make the sacrifices. From living in his van to rolling burritos, he's done whatever it takes to get to the top, and it looks like it's starting to pay off. So, without further ado, here's Dakota Norton. Dakota Norton, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. How's it going?
Yeah, things are going good. Thanks for having me. I'm excited about it.
Excellent. Good stuff. Well, let's, start a lot of these off, let's start from the start. Tell us a little bit about your childhood. And I think, was it motocross was kind of your first love?
Yeah. For me, so I grew up in Michigan, which is, if no one, knows about the Midwest or the USA, it's literally as flat as a board. I mean, there are no mountains, nothing to see. For as far as you look, it's just horizon. So I grew up racing motocross, started riding at a real young age. I was like, I think 3 years old, 4 years old, something like that. Oh. Like, real early, and was always involved in motorsports. My dad raced motocross growing up, and that was kind of the natural transition for me. I, rode dirt bikes in the spring and summer. And then once it was wintertime, we'd, do outdoors things. We'd go ice fishing like they do up there in the north and ride snowmobiles. So I always had a motorsports background, and that was my first true love and something that still inspires me and is a big part of my program today. And yeah, motocross was my thing. It was always my first dream, as a lot of mountain bikers, to be a professional motocross racer.
Yeah, definitely. There's a good crossover there, isn't there? A lot of people want to follow that path. But BMX kind of came in at some point. Where did that switch happen? How did that come about?
So I raced motocross until, I guess, even into high school, but I got out of it heavily, like 13, 14 years old. My parents split, and that was just kind of the end of motocross racing. When my family was together, it was a big thing. And then once, you have all the stuff that comes along with, your parents splitting up, limited resources, limited time, and yeah. It just, not as much dirt bikes happened. So I needed something to fill that void or that space. And I honestly just started riding like my local skate park, and it kind of transitioned. I was always a competitive person. It was kind of just bred in me at a young age. So I obviously leaned towards something that was, you know, racing. I always loved racing and competing, and started racing BMX. Did that, you know, I was really bad at it, honestly. When I first started, I was never really a naturally gifted athlete. Never really athletically gifted by any means when it comes to, like, you know, strength and fitness. And that's something that all kind of came out of necessity for me to compete in that sport. So I really didn't even go to the gym until I was probably 18, 19 years old, you know, fully out of high school. I didn't go to the gym at all in high school. And so I just was really bad at it and wanted to be good so bad. And that I found a way to get good at it and raced BMX into my mid-20s. And I actually never would have found mountain biking if it wasn't for BMX. I went to a school in Kentucky. I always thought that I hated the cold, for one. I was like, I want to be out of the cold. So I wanted to go south. And I was like, you have to put yourself in a position to be successful around people that are also driven and want to go, you know, to the next level with whatever their craft is. So for me, that was Lindsey Wilson College. It was a school in Kentucky that I just applied to. I was just going to community college up in Michigan and fully, you know, just applied and went down there, checked out the school. And within a matter of a couple of days, I was living there, going to college down there. And that's how I started mountain biking.
Yeah. Is it fair to say Michigan was a fairly kind of rough part of the country at the point when you were growing up?
Yeah. So I grew up, a lot of my childhood was in Grand Rapids. And with that whole, you know, graduating high school, I actually moved to live with my mom which is Flint, Michigan. And that's a super, super rough area with, you know, the whole General Motors, the auto industry was the capital of the auto industry. And, you know, as that kind of fell apart, so did the economy there.
Yeah. Yeah. So a pretty challenging place to grow up, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, we've went from, you know, the money you spend racing motocross. So I've been on both sides of it. I've been where, like, you know, we're not hurting, to like full single mom, two kids, definitely challenging situation there. So I've been on both sides of the coin as a kid growing up, and it just really opened your eyes. And, you know, I was just working at a bike shop and, you know, moving furniture and just working odd jobs and going to college, never really making much money, and just living to ride my bike on the weekends to, you know, fully, now I'm race my bike for the living, and I race my bike for a living at the highest level there is. So yeah. Pretty
big change. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of different perspectives.
Yeah. Was that a conscious decision then to kind of get away from Flint, Michigan, to go to college like somewhere else and try and escape that environment?
I think for me, it wasn't a conscious decision to get out of Flint, Michigan. It was just to put myself in a better position to try to achieve my goals. And, you know, there was a lot of really, really talented individuals at that school. And I actually was lucky enough to train almost every day with Danny Kellogg, who is a, you know, Olympic. He's went to the Olympics in 2012. I mean, he's won the BMX or the overall title, you know, so many years in a row. He's like super, super talented individual. And he kind of pulled me under his wing, and I got to train every day with an Olympian and one of the best in the sport of BMX. So that was, I learned so much. It was like so cool for me. And now he's one of my best friends. And JD Swanguin, he was there, you know, so that I never would have even rode a mountain bike if he didn't let me ride a slalom bike, and I fell in love right away. So yeah, that was, yeah, just a cool environment, really.
Yeah. Yeah. So slalom was the first kind of side of mountain biking that excited you. Yeah.
Yeah. It was, it felt like I was riding my dirt bike again. I mean, I probably at that point in time hadn't rode a dirt bike in 4 or 5 years and was, you know, only racing BMX. And it was just like, you know, turning the dirt, traction, jumps, you know, suspension. And to me, it was suspension at the time, even though it was a dirt jumper. But it literally just felt like I was on my dirt bike again. And that's, I guess, why it kind of scratched that itch, if you will, filled that void for me. So
yeah. And was it an obvious choice then for you to go racing? It sounds like it would have been.
Yeah. I raced the collegiate races and really enjoyed it. Kind of struggled because I didn't really have a bike of my own. And when I did, it was kind of falling apart. And, you know, just the typical, you know, transitionary challenges that you have. So for me, it was just like, yeah, this is really awesome. But I didn't really want to give up racing BMX right away, even though I really loved mountain bikes, just because I felt like I hadn't really checked my goals off the list over there, if you will. I mean, I just didn't achieve the things in the sport I wanted to. And it took me to getting to the point where I was like, okay, I'm done with this. And it took probably 6 months to a year of still racing BMX till I felt like I was at a point in my career where I had achieved the things that I wanted to.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and how far did you get with the BMX side of things? I'm not that familiar with it as a sport. But...
So realistically, I just raced amateur. I never even turned pro. I got to the point where I could turn pro, and that was a big goal for me. And in the sport of BMX, there's some big incentives from like the factory teams for like team overall money. So they will support amateur racers until that they can go double A pro. They don't really support semi pros as much. Mm-hmm. So it's either you're the best amateur and you try to stay amateur until you can fully go double A pro. So I was racing some really, really talented individuals, Jordan Miranda, Tyler Whitfield, I mean, Chandler Denton, dudes that were really, really good BMX racers. And just being competitive there, I think I got third at the Music City National in Nashville, Tennessee. And that was like, I felt like I was at the point where I could turn pro. And that's when I finally felt like I'm satisfied with this and I'm ready to move on.
Okay. And at that point, had you already discovered downhill? Did that come in through the collegiate racing side?
Yeah, it came through. I actually bought, at that time I had a downhill bike. I bought Shane Leslie's, he's another kid from the Midwest, probably the only other kid that's come out of the Midwest and raced World Cups. I bought his three-year-old Santa Cruz V10 that, I mean, he raced and then his dad raced for a few years, and it was like, it was fully pretty clapped out at the time. I don't even know if the fork worked on the thing, but yeah, I bought that from them, and I was racing that in collegiate. So yeah, that was, I had a downhill bike and I'd raced a few college races, and that was about as far as I had went with it.
Yeah. And how long had you been involved in the downhill side of things then before you thought going to a World Cup was what you wanted to do?
You know, the World Cup thing just kind of realistically kind of fell in my lap a bit. I just applied on a whim and got a petition spot. But in 2015, I had started to race some bigger races with the help of a friend, James McAllister. He was a guy that I met in the skate park in Michigan. And, you know, we had talked about racing mountain bikes, and I went to my first non-collegiate mountain bike race with him and Shane Leslie's dad and Shane and Charlie Harrison at the time. And they were on, I guess it's, I don't know the exact name. It was the ODI satellite team, that I think Aaron ran. And they were at that year, I think Shane won the Rouen Junior National Championships, and Charlie was right there with them. They were both really, really talented bike riders at the time. And I ended up winning Cat 1 by 18 seconds. So it was my first non-college race. It was in the mud, and I got 14th place in pro. And it was really, really cool. Like I rode with Shane and Charlie a little bit in practice, and you know, at the time they were super pro and didn't, you know, pay me any attention really. But I was just kind of in the back of their pit, didn't even know how to change my tires, didn't know what mud tires were. So my buddy gave me some mud tires to run. I was still running, you know, tubes and just like the thickest tube I could find, so I didn't get a flat. And I luckily got one lap with Charlie. I got to follow him down, and I didn't stay with him very long, but I knew what pace I had to run. And one of our friends just said, oh, just go ride like you're riding behind Charlie, mate. You'll be all right. And that's what I did. And I did really well. And it was super cool experience. And from that, James just called me one day. I was going to collegiate national titles, and he said to me, "What if I could get you $5,000 to go racing next year? Would you want to race mountain bikes?" And I'm like, it was like, I almost didn't even get my hopes up. It sounded too good to be true to me. You know, I was just like, I think I was actually like at Chick-fil-A with the college team, like getting some food or something on the trip. And I was like, I didn't even know what to think. And you know, I sat there in the bus on the way to College Nats, and you just thought about it the whole time. And I was like, you know, that'd be the coolest thing ever. That would be like, to me at the time, was like a life changer, you know? So he ended up getting me 10 from Precision Components, which is like a machining company in Michigan. And yeah, we went racing, and that's the year I won Pro Duel at Crankworks and raced 2 World Cups. I got 11th at my first ever Pro GRT. I was, I remember how much time, but right off Bryn Atkinson. So it was, cool year, really.
Big year. Yeah. And am I right in saying you borrowed your granddad's minivan to go to the World Cups?
Yeah. I mean, at the time I didn't really even have a reliable car, and you know, I had a Trek session that was just bone stock out of the box. And I had a slalom bike and a hardtail, and that's, I actually don't, even halfway through the year, I didn't even own a trail bike. So we went to Mount St. Anne, and I crashed twice and was like, got 100th and 80 qualified. And that was like, dude, I bawled and cried, and I was like so upset. And yeah, I was just like, I just tried to ride so fast. And coming out of B practice, like, it rained, the track changed so much, and then it started raining right before finals. And I didn't, like, to me, I had no idea. I didn't even literally know who Aaron Gwynn was. I had no idea who anyone was in the pit, any of the teams, anything. I'd never even been exposed to anything like that before. And I was just there with a box full of dented wheels and sleeping in the back of my granddad's minivan and trying to make, I don't even know what I was doing. I literally didn't know the schedule, how many qualified. I just knew that I had to ride really fast. And I remember I flipped the bars in the upper woods, and my bike like went through the tape, and like I had to run out of the track and go get it. I got going again. And then I got to the open, like after the Stevie Smith Rock Roll, which I don't think was there at the time. And I just fully lost both wheels out in the open and slid and crashed and got going again and got down to the bottom and was in 100th or 101st place or something like that. And I was like, really not that far off qualifying. And I'm just like, you know, full bonehead. Like, and then we went to Wyndham the next weekend, and my trainer at the time, Ben Clark, was there, which he had helped me with the first year of mountain biking. And he kind of gave me a little more guidance and helped me warm up at the top and gave me, you know, some instructions, if you will. And I ended up getting 54th there. Nice. So that was pretty cool. It was the first mountain bike race that my mom and my sister had been able to come to. My granddad was there. So yeah, it was really, really cool. I've literally until this day never seen my grandpa cry. And when I came down, he was really proud, and he like had tears in his eyes, and it was probably one of the most special moments of my life for sure. Still, even to this day, racing, that was one of the coolest things I've ever done, was race in a USA petition jersey. I think I had a 124 plate on, and just people screaming USA all the way down the track. It was really cool. It's really cool.
And your granddad's been a big influence on you, I get the impression.
Yeah, he's pretty important to me. He's probably my favorite person on this planet by a long shot. He's the hardest working dude I know. He always does things the right way. He never cuts any corners. He's just hardworking old timer that, I mean, every time I see him, he goes, "How's racing going?" And he, you know, he doesn't know a whole lot about, you know, contracts and sponsors. And he's like, "They still happy with you? Still getting paid?" I'm like, "Yeah, we're still getting to the races, Gramps."
Awesome. So, sounds like a dude.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Wicked, wicked. And so after those first couple of World Cups, then what had you learned? What did you realize you needed to do to work your way up?
I guess the big thing is I just needed to, my career has never been, like I said, I it's never been a game of like, I need to really work on my riding so much. I had to work on strength and fitness. I had to work on getting my life organized. I mean, when I moved out of college, it was, you know, I lived in Michigan, and the only time I would ever ride is at the races. So it wasn't like I need to change bike setup, I need to do this or that. It was, I'd never really pedaled cross country at all. So I needed to get fit, you know, transition from a BMX racer that's good for 20 seconds, you know, and six hard pedals out of the gate to like, you know, being fit for 3.5 minutes. And then just kind of get seat time. I would drive 10 hours to ride downhill, and I'd only get to ride at the races. So I needed to put myself in a better position. Again, the same change. I need to be in a position to be successful. So I just bought a little sprinter van and, you know, packed it up and just drove down south and figured it out. I mean, at one point in time, I literally drove my van down there and was staying at Christopher Grice's house. So if you guys have heard of him, he's a junior on the specialized gravity program this year. And at the time, yeah, he was just, I mean, he was so small. He was a little guy. I mean, it was a few years ago now. And, you know, I stayed with them for a little while and actually just rolled burritos at Chipotle. I drove my van down and applied for every single job I could find on Craigslist. And the first person that calls me, I took the job. I think I worked for like 4 or 5 hours a day rolling burritos. And I'd go ride trail bikes after and ride downhill on the weekend. And I just kind of did that for, I mean, maybe not roll burritos, but just did odd jobs for a while. And then rode on the weekends and just tried to get as much seat time as I could and pedal when I could. And kind of, if you have a dollar to spend, I just put it in the downhill basket and tried to be as good at that as I could. And not really all the other pieces to the puzzle that you need at this, like where I am in my career now, to be at the pointy bit of it. But I mean, at the time I was just trying to qualify, make it to the race on Sunday.
Fair play. How long did you live in the van for? Cause you ended up parked on Sean Leader's drive for a while.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So I knew that Windrock was where I needed to be for riding to develop my skills. And he was nice enough to let me park up by the chicken coop. I kept my bike in his chicken coop for a while. There's no chickens in it at that point, but and then parked my van next to it and kind of, you know, used my van as a place to sleep and then hung out with those guys. And I did that for a good 2 years, realistically, until I got onto the Da Vinci program. And even in the first year of the Da Vinci program, I was still at Sean's house and just kind of making it work. I mean,
wow. Okay, yeah. Fair play. So, yeah, so you did 2016 and 2017 full World Cup seasons as a privateer?
Yep.
How was that? How do you make it work? Because it's got to be pretty challenging, like financially and also from an energy perspective, because you're trying to fit in work, training, racing, travel, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I rode for Morpheus at the time and they gave me some help getting to the races and a little bit here and there to kind of buy some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and keep me rolling. And getting to the races, I mean, my buddy Jason Schroeder was working for 100% on the at the time, so he'd sometimes let me crash on his floor. And sometimes I'd crash in the van, sometimes I'd, you know, have a place to stay. And I just kind of made it all come together, you know, pretty much go over there, rent a van, go racing, and, you know, get sick of asking people for a tire pump. Hey, can I use your pump? But I mean, the first year, it was first couple of years there, it was challenging. I mean, you know, you weren't racing on Sunday and it just felt like anything that could go wrong would go wrong and it would happen in qualifying. And, you know, just the whole thing, the fear of failure, the, you know, you've put every single thing you have into this and you have to perform and it's, you know, like a real show trying to put it all together. I mean, you're taking both wheels off your bike to fit it in your rental car to get back to the hotel. You know, I mean, you're parked way up on the hill. You got to walk way up the hill at Val d'Isole to get to your pit. And, you know, there's all these things that you take for granted when you're on a program like I am now, but you know, it was was difficult those first few years trying to put the pieces to the puzzle together and make that jump to get onto one of these teams. But that's really all you're chasing, right?
Yeah. Was there ever a point where you considered quitting it, or was it always the thing you were going to do?
I think that I was so invested in it that quitting wasn't an option. Like, so many people had helped me get to where I was. It wasn't even an option to quit. Like James, you know, my family, like it never went through my head. And I think that's one of the things you see from a lot of these kids that go over there. They're just not willing to get beaten down long enough to where they figure it out and it starts turning around. Because I think when you go to Europe, it's challenging just being in Europe as a whole, let alone racing over there with no help. You know, I think a lot of these kids, they go over there a few times and they get beat and then they just kind of give up. And I think that the difference between the dudes that make it to the next level and the don't are the dudes that are willing to just keep going over there and riding the steeper, faster tracks until they figure it out.
Wait, what is it about Europe that makes it tricky for people coming from elsewhere, do you think? Is it just the terrain?
Yeah, I think that there's the pressure to perform over there with those riders. You know, it's a much different environment. For me, maybe it was different because I didn't grow up racing mountain bikes, but the big trucks, the pits, the flashy lights kind of thing is really intimidating for one. I think in Europe, you're controlling speed. Speed isn't really the issue. It's controlling the speed on the steeper, rougher, slipperier tracks. And that's kind of something that is kind of controversial, right? You know, when I say the tracks are rougher, but if you take a track like Mountain Creek in the USA, where you're always trying to pump and generate speed the whole lap and you're pedaling and trying to go faster, to say a track like Val d'Isole, where you're braking the majority of the track and trying to control your speed, it's just much different. It's a different style of racing than I think what we have here in the USA.
Yeah, fair play. And through all of that, you're working in off seasons and between races at all, or how are you making it work? Because you've got a bit of money, I guess, support from Morpheus, but I'm guessing not enough to live off.
Yeah, nah, enough to sleep in my van off, you know, and that's not. And I was very fortunate, you know. A lot of dudes don't even really have that, you know. So, you work all winter. So as soon as the race season's done, you go to work and you work all winter long until the first race is coming up. And then, you know, a few weeks before the first race, you stop working and try to get as much downhill bike time as you can and then go racing. And, you know, I didn't work a whole lot in between the seasons just because it was, you know, there's so many races, but, you know, you try to make a little money here and there at a couple local races and then just really try not to just spend any money. Like, try not to spend a dollar if you don't have to, and save every dollar you have from working in the off season to get you to the next race. And you know, I just kind of hustle.
Yeah. So it's a lot of sacrifice, I suppose. Like, social life's got to go out the window to an extent.
Yeah. You really
got no money to do that.
Yeah. You really have to choose what you want. And if it's racing that you want, it's just a lot of the other things what is normal life, just you really can't do it. You just have to choose what it is that you're gonna focus on, and then focus all your energy and financial, you know, the financial aspect of it, and just really do that one thing.
Yeah. And 2017 seems like a year where that really started to pay off for you, and your results definitely took a jump up, and you know, you were getting into the thick end of the field. Are there any kind of things that you can put your finger on that you think clicked for you coming into that or throughout that season?
I don't think that. Yeah, 17, I started to get up there. I was running maybe in the mid 30s that most of that year, and I think that I just learned how fast you could go. I could go on my setup without going hitting the ground or breaking a wheel, or just learning that, like, this is my speed, and if I ride my speed, this is what it'll be at the end of the day, and not try to push above that, but try to rise to that consistent speed from out of the starting gate to the bottom. And it became, you know, for me, my artistry and my technique changed a lot. You know, I quit I quit jumping, you know, doing so much like popping through things, and started to be a little lighter on the bike and a little better with my line choice and learning, you know, to brake a little sooner, carry a little more exit speed, and just learned how to put a race run together, really. And knowing how fast that I could go, because I felt like at that point in time, I kind of had a speed limit. And if I would try to ride over my speed limit, I would crash. And instead of riding the whole track at one consistent speed, I'd try to ride one section so abnormally fast, like, you know, pin it for all it was worth, 120% through this one section that I was confident in. And then I'd end up going down and be, you know, in the corner on my head. But just learning that to put the pieces to the puzzle together from start to finish, instead of just trying to pin it for all it's worth and beat everybody in one section.
Yeah. Is patience a fair word to use? Like taking a more patient approach to it?
Yeah, I think patience is important, but I think it was just learning to trust myself and my abilities and my speed, and learning to be like, cause you have that fear of failure, fear of being inadequate, or, you know, never really reaching your potential, things like that. So you bring all these emotions into your racing, and you're like, is it going to be fast enough? Is this not? Just being okay with what it's going to be and going out and riding your race, no matter how fast any of the other guys are going to go or what lines they're doing, just being secure enough with your abilities to just go do your run and being okay with whatever that's going to be. Riding your race, I guess, is the biggest thing that clicked for me in 17.
Yeah, I've heard that you don't really like to watch many of the other riders on the track. Like, you always feel they're going way faster than you are when you watch them through a section.
Yeah, and that's, I guess, kind of part of it. You know, you'll stand on the side of the track and you never know what you look like. You never know how fast you're going. And if you just, you know, and at that point in time, I'd see dudes go through and, you know, you'd pull out onto the track and you'd get five corners down and then Fairclaw's like about to run you over, you know? So, I mean, it's cause those dudes are, you know, it's just normal for them. And you're riding tight and stiff and, you know, you finally get in, you know, a practice and you maybe still don't have time training, but, you know, those dudes have rode a few of these tracks year after year and they're fully up to speed and then you're just like trying to survive out there really sometimes. I mean, you see those and then you pull off and see those dudes go by and there's like no way I could ever ride that fast. And after a while you do it long enough and then you start looking at those dudes in practice and then you start seeing your name on the results list and where you stack up. And it's like, okay, that's what I look like too.
And okay. So you feel better about watching the other riders now that you know that you're in that.
I think you know, it's all relative, right? You know, I mean, you're looking at the names that you're around on the results list and you still like, you know, when you're in 17, I'd see Danny Hart go by and I'd just be like, whoa, you know that those dudes are going that speed, but even the dudes that you're around, you're like, oh, I'm not going that fast. And then, you know, you I guess you just start to settle in and realize where you're at, I guess.
Yeah. Fair play. And is it also true you're not a big fan of using time at a World Cup? You don't like to necessarily like analyze the track based on how quick you were through sectors and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Because I'm a rider that's always a little slower at the first split, and that's something I've been working on. But I'm also a dude that always has really, really good last splits. And I will, for some reason, I really struggle to do it without the pressure. I don't know if it's just the fact that I manage risk or I can't get my head around going that speed until it's all on the line, but I'll go down in time training and I'll go as hard as I can and I'll just be kind of not where I want to be a lot of the time. And then qualifying comes around and I'll go a bit faster and then I'll put my GoPro on and say do a full run on race day and practice or whatever. And in the race run, I always go faster. So it's like I don't know what time I can run because I don't know how fast I'm going to go when it counts. It always changes. So I don't really look at, you know, some dudes look at the times when they're going up or some dudes kind of know what time they can run And I consistently always go faster throughout the weekend. And my race runs are always way faster than qualifying, even if the track's the same. I don't know. There's something that clicks in my head that in the past has allowed me to do it when it counts. So we'll see this year if that's there or not. But it's just kind of being able to turn your brain off and just perform when it matters.
So how do you judge personally whether you're like in a good place on a track or at a venue over a weekend? If you're not looking at times, like a lot of teams have got people up on the hill with stopwatches and putting timing beacons out and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
How do you know when, is it purely down to feel?
Yeah, for me, I think a lot of people are trying to figure out, you know, what the fastest line on the track is or, you know, where they stack up and trying to figure all these things out. And really, I just go to a race and try to relax and ride loose and ride like I ride at home. And I know that if I'm not uptight and I come out of the gate and I shut my brain off quickly, settle into my run, I'm not fighting it, I know that it's going to be a good run and I'm going to be where I want to be at the bottom. For me, it's not really a time thing. It's a feel thing. I know that if I get 3/4 of the way down and I start thinking, oh, it's going to be a good run, don't mess it up. You know, I'm sure you've heard that before, but if I can shut my head off and just ride my bike, I'm going to be in a good place. And that's really what I strive to do every weekend is just let it be. Act on instinct and let it be something that just happens naturally. And that's kind of what I've always strived to do is just go out there and relax and ride, not loose as in like sliding everywhere, drifting, blowing dirt up in the corners, but just ride loose on the bike and let it happen.
And do you have any techniques then to help get yourself into that headspace for a race run?
I try to not. Yeah, it's hard because I train a lot for that. And I say we, last year, me and Nico, which me and Nico Malawi do quite a bit of training together. And I'm super, super lucky to have him to bounce ideas off because he's been doing it for forever. And it's really nice to have someone to do the work with and it makes it a lot more enjoyable. But last year we did a lot of mock races and that's the big thing that I was working on is just going out there and just shutting my brain off and going into that place where I perform. And, you know, I got a couple races under my belt and I knew I could go there and I could do that thing that I do what happens when you're racing, you know? So I don't really know even how to explain it, get in that headspace. That's what I work for. That's why I kind of do the preparation that I do. And yeah.
And the mock races, you literally put together like a World Cup schedule, but just at Windrock, for example.
Yeah. Well, just, you know, it's people probably think I am crazy when I say this, but you know, I had a couple times last year where it was just me and him warming up there and a couple other kids that would kind of, you know, get in and participate for some practice runs. But, you know, there'd be no tape on the side of the track and I'd pedal out of the gate like it was a race run. And, you know, the only person I'm racing is Nico and I don't want to let him beat me and he doesn't want me to beat him. So it's like, you know, we're really trying just because for pride, I guess. I don't really know, but I'd get to the bottom and I'd put down a race run and I'd get to the bottom and I'd go out into the parking lot and go to the timing system and then like almost wait for my time to be announced. And then I'd look around like, well, there's no one here. That's right. It's not a race. And it was,
wow, you got so into it.
Yeah. It was really, really weird. It happened to me twice where like I would get so into my race runs that I wouldn't even realize that I wasn't really racing.
That's awesome. Well, it shows it's working.
Yeah. So, that's the thing. That's the reassuring thing that I try to get before the race season, before we go to the World Cups. And I guess I haven't really done a lot of racing this year because the first World Cup is so early. That it's like kind of, you know, it's a kind of nerve wracking for me to be like, is it going to click? Like, am I going to ride stiff and tight and be like, you know, fighting it the whole time? Am I going to be able to settle in, shut my head off and do a race run? You know, it's kind of the nerve-wracking thing for me this year is I haven't done as much preparation, like mock races and stuff like that. So it's it's kind of a nervous thing for me to be like, you know, is it going to happen or am I going to fight it? So,
you know how it works now. Yeah. You'll be all good. Yeah. Cool. But yeah, so 2017 then, results are obviously improving, but it was, I think, Val d'Isol that was a real turning point and where you started to get noticed.
Yeah.
But you weren't even on your own bike, were you, that weekend?
Yeah, no, I just, bike didn't show up, had issues, and was on a just kind of a borrowed bike. I think I got a few laps on it, threw some settings on it, a little bit of low speed compression, you know, adjusted my rebound and got my pressures in a general area that would work and raced it. And that was,
first time at Val d'Isol as well.
Yeah, it was my first time. Actually, the first lap of practice, I got there late because I had bike issues, flight issues, missed track walk. And so I just rode down the track first lap of practice. And I ended up like, there's that bottom right-hand corner that's like, you know, infamously tight and steep. And I just blew over the bars into the catch net first lap. And I remember just being like, wow, here we are. And this track was so rough and so gnarly. And I was just like, I didn't even know what to think. I'm on a foreign bike. I'm not really, you know, comfortable at all with what's going on. You know, there's like that year it didn't rain, but it was like, you know, 6 inches of dirt over roots. And you couldn't see it was such a strange thing because you couldn't see what was under the ground, what you were hitting. It was just like dry and powder everywhere. And you'd just like be riding along. And next thing you know, you're like tank slapping about to go down and you don't even know what you hit. It was such a strange thing for me. So foreign. And yeah, did well at that race. And just, that was when I guess it kind of came together. And that's the race that, where I really put down my run that I knew I was capable of. And that's what kind of opened the door, I guess, for me to getting on a factory team the following year.
Yeah, so that was 14th place at that event, wasn't it, I think? Did teams start coming to you? Like, how did that all pan out?
There was a little bit of interest, and I definitely, you know, made it known that I was looking for a ride. And it actually was to the point where I didn't know if I was going to race the following year. Like I was like, it was really, really late when I ended up getting a ride. Like I think when I got the call, I was digging rocks out of a corner at Windrock, was working out there. And, at the time, you know, working different jobs, and it was pretty late for me. And I didn't know if I was really going to have a ride, and just kind of said like, hey, like, I'm going to go fast if I can get some help. It's going to happen. And just kind of was, you know, told myself that, and then, you know, told the guys that at Da Vinci. And I was like, you know, this is what I want to do. Like, I'm really, really ready to ride really fast, I guess. And and it worked out because it was, you know, I had a few teams that had kind of talked to me, and everyone had kind of just been like, yeah, I just don't really know if we're going to have any room, or, hey, we signed somebody, and it was just like at the point where I was just like, I kind of almost gave up some. I was just like, well, you know, it was cool. Unfortunately, like, I couldn't afford to do it again on my own by any means. Like, without any help, there was no way that I could afford to go racing again and do it on my own. And I was just like, if I don't get a ride, I'm not going to race next year. And that was cool. And just get a job and ride my motorbike on the weekends, you know?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it ended up working out. And yeah, it was nerve-wracking there for a minute. And then
I bet.
First race on the team, got a podium. So that kind of,
yeah, that's cool. That's a big turnaround. So what was that first winter like then, I guess? So immediately it takes pressure of work off of you, I suppose.
Yeah. Not? Yeah. So I wasn't working as much, but it was kind of late. So, you know, things still weren't settled, you know, like it wasn't like, oh, my life changed right then. You know, it's like first year on a factory team, you're usually not, you know, making heaps of money, and you, but you know, you're going to go to the races, you know, you're going to have good support. So you kind of just put all your eggs in that basket and go for it, really. It's kind of a hard thing because you know that you have big commitments and you have a lot of pressure, but you're still kind of in the same financial position and same life position you were as a privateer. You know, it takes some time for these things to kind of work themselves out. But you know, with the testing and, you know, getting time on the bike ahead of time and stuff, it's a lot more reassuring to be able to go over there and ride with some teammates and get your bike dialed in and get that confidence of, you know, you have good support and a good operating bike, and, you know, you don't have to worry about going to the races and making sure your tires are going to hold air. You know, you can sit down and you can put your feet up and focus on the racing aspect of things and take the time to, you know, find those little advantages on the track, you know, replay your GoPro in between runs and be, oh, maybe I could be a little bit over here, or maybe I could be a little bit over there, other than like, oh, I need to put my race wheels on and swap rotors and wipe my bike down and do a bolt check and, you know, all those things that you do when you're a privateer.
Yeah, fair play. So you turned up at Lozenge in 2018, feeling pretty good then. What did you think when you saw the track?
Yeah, I was pretty nervous about it. And I think I, you know, and that's something we were talking about the other day, is that place is so different, and that there's just a bunch of sharp rock, and it's, you know, I really don't like loose rocks. And, you know, we were riding at our team camp a couple weeks ago, and Greg Callahan was like, oh yeah, the EWS stages, you know, they got loose rocks all over them. And I'm like thinking of lotion there. I was like, I really don't like loose rocks laying on the track. And that's, that's all that place was, like, you know, jagged stuff going, you know, everywhere. And, yeah, didn't really like the place. If I would pick a track again that I thought I would do real well on, I definitely wouldn't pick that one.
Yeah. So how did you feel then? Cause you obviously had a pretty awesome run.
Yeah.
And I think you went into the hot seat, didn't you, when you got down?
Yeah.
What was it like?
I don't know. Like, I got super pumped up before the race run in the hotel room. And I was definitely I'm going to go for it. And felt like I didn't really, you know, have a lot to lose at that point. Cause it's like, you know, if I do a good run, it's cool. But if I don't, I'm still going to the race the following weekend. Like, you know, it's not like all relying on this one run to get to the next race and so on, like it was in the past. So I just got so pumped up and just went for it and rode as fast as I could. And I honestly almost crashed in the first corner, pushed the front wheel so bad, blew my feet out of the pedals. Don't know how I didn't go down. Definitely came in way too hot, and then was like all jittery and fired up and just kept going and kept, you know, giving it all the way down. And I got to the bottom and I knew it was as fast as I could go. It was like everything that I had, everything that I wanted. And I didn't even know that I did that good of a run when I got to the bottom. I was just so pumped up that I put down the run that I wanted, you know, and like gave it everything I had, and it worked out. And I was so pumped at the bottom, and then just sat there and sat there and sat there. And yeah, I ended up getting on the podium.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Coolest feeling.
And quite a place to be on a podium as well, right? With the water there and everything. Like,
yeah, it was crazy. Cause I walked out onto the podium and I didn't know, even know what side to go on, like didn't know what to do. I was literally clueless. And then I walked around the corner and it was like, you know, a good 50 feet until the next of water until, you know, the next, I guess it'd be pier or whatever. And there was so many people, like the whole, you know, from the waterfront to the buildings, as far as you could see was people. And I was just like, it was the coolest moment of my life. Like, absolutely unreal, insane, cool thing. Like, I'll remember it. That's one of the coolest things that's ever happened to me in my life, like being up there. And, you know, yeah, obviously you get fired up, you want to get another one. But I think that one was special just because it, you know, you're on the sea there, there's boats, there's, you know, you can see all the photographers and all the people, and just because it was so spread out, you know, it was pretty cool. Yeah.
And did you all end up in the water as
Yeah. I don't remember who jumped in first, but at that point, I mean, I think we all, we all had to jump in. It's a pretty unique podium. So that is a, yeah, cool memory. You know, nice. Being there, three-man American podium was pretty sweet too, to be a part of that.
Yeah, that's very cool. Very cool indeed. And you backed it up as well a bit later in the season with a sixth place at Liaogang.
Yeah, Liaogang.
Super close.
Yeah, I had a little slide out in the last corner too and was like 0.2 off Loris, I think. And yeah, I was almost made it back onto the podium and then was riding really good that beginning of that season and was really confident and really, really going as fast as I could every weekend. And I guess maybe sometimes a little bit too fast, but somehow putting it together.
Yeah. And then Crankworx Innsbruck was an unfortunate one, I guess.
Yeah. I just, I got a little bit offline. I had kind of faded wide in one of these off camber corners a couple times in practice. And there's kind of like a pine tree and it kind of clip you a little bit when you went through it. And I didn't think anything of it. And so you couldn't really see the trees after the pine tree. And I just came out a little bit wide and clipped my handlebar on the right side. And it grazed the side of my hand and just barely caught the edge of the handlebar. And it was right off a compression into some roots. And it just kind of like shot me left off this little rise into this compression. And as soon as I like hit the roots and stuff, it just faded me left into the trees. I was kind of off balance when I hit the roots and just smoked a tree with my shoulder and dislocated my shoulder. And that was pretty much the end of me having that, you know, that confidence that I was riding on for sure. And made it really hard the rest of the season with my shoulder dislocating and still trying to ride through it and trying to still compete and, you know, go home, try to get as healthy as I could and come back. But realistically, once you miss a round or two, those dudes, the level continues to rise and it's pretty hard to come back in and compete after that, especially with an injury.
Right. Yeah. Fair play. Yeah. So was there a decision then to make about whether you went straight for surgery or whether you carried on for the rest of the season? Or at that point, was it hopeful that you didn't need surgery?
Yeah. I guess it probably maybe would have been a little smarter to have my surgery and just get it done. But I mean, I had to kind of race through the rest of the year to make sure I had a ride the following year. So it wasn't like I was real secure and I could just sit back and have the surgery and get healthy and get back to it the next season. I had to continue to still race. So, went home and, had it looked at a bit. And did as much work as I could to keep it in and went back racing, rode in a brace, and unfortunately pulled it back out again at Val d'Isol in qualifying. So after that, it was, you know, a big, big struggle through the rest of the season because you didn't know if it was going to come out or not. And I was really weak. You know, I couldn't do 10 pushups. And, you know, I remember racing at World Champs and in Lenzerheide and putting down everything I had. And it was just, I was like 20 something and I wasn't even close just because I couldn't hit the compressions that hard anymore. I just was not strong enough.
Yeah. So, yeah. Fair play. But, so did you have surgery in the off season then that year?
Yep. So I had surgery, actually pretty late in the off season. I had surgery back up in Michigan. I kind of had some issues getting in with a doctor and getting my surgery date and stuff like that. So it was pretty tight coming into, last year because it was real late. I only got to ride for, you know, a month or so before the first World Cup. So got it fixed up. Had my labrum fixed and got ready for the following season.
Yeah. So talk us through that season a little bit. You ended up finishing 15th overall, I think, in 2019, which is pretty good. I'm guessing maybe not where you wanted to be. I don't know. How do you feel looking back on it?
Yeah. Looking back on the season from where I started the season to where I finished, I was really proud of the season that I put together. You know, we went to our team camp in Finale and that was actually the first time I even rode a downhill bike. And I came back straight from Finale back to a test camp here at Windrock with RockShox and rode there for 3 weeks. And then it was pretty much time to go racing. And it's not, luckily I got to ride my downhill bike for the first week in the dry and that kind of built some confidence. But I was still, you know, really, really hurt and I just didn't, I wasn't strong enough. You know, you have a big injury like that and you think you just like, you know, once you get it fixed, you bounce back. But I mean, there's so much rehab you have to do, strengthening and stuff like that. So to go into Maribor, and I think I remember what I got, maybe 10th, or it was like 10th place, 13th, something like that. And that was pretty, you know, mind blowing for me to go from, you know, sleeping in a chair in my mom's living room in Michigan when it's, you know, negative 20 out, to like, here I am at the World Cup. And it was such a short period of time. And I, you know, did so much rehab and did everything I possibly could to be ready. And it, you know, paid off. But I was still, as far as, you know, being a percentage, I wasn't even 90% of what I was the previous year in strength and stuff like that. So, and you know, confidence and bike time and all these things, you know. So the season that I put together last year, I, you know, struggled with my back being real weak all year. And, you know, once you're in the race season, there's only so much you can do because you're pretty much, you're racing a lot, and then you don't get a big block to build real strength. So it's like, you know, you get to do some rehab movements at the races, and then you get a couple weeks in the gym, and then you're going back racing again. So, for where I started to where I finished, I couldn't have asked for a better season. I crashed at a couple events, and that was kind of comes back to that whole thing of believing and trusting your speed. And, you know, that whole not really being on pace at the first split, I, you know, kind of took last year as a learning year because, mm-hmm. you know, I was a little more secure with being able to race the following year, and I was in a multi-year deal for the first time ever. So it took some of the risk away. I could go and go to one race and try to go really hard at the first split and then maintain to the bottom. And, you know, sometimes I'd build too much speed and I'd, you know, crash at the third split, or, you know, try to ride too fast and try to be up there fighting for a podium. I'd be real confident. Like at Leogang, I felt like I could, you know, fight for a podium and be up there challenging it. I went for it, and unfortunately it didn't work out. So it was kind of a learning year last year because I wasn't, you know, maybe 100% fitness, 100% strength. So I took it as an opportunity to kind of try some things with my racecraft at the races and see if I could, you know, find what works for me. And sometimes it worked out, sometimes it didn't. But if you would have plugged in, say, a 15th place finish for the three races that I crashed at, I would have had a 9th in the overall. So yeah. when you actually break it down and look at it, you know, at the end of the season, I figured it out and I put it together. You know, I went to World Champs and got 8th. I got 9th at Snowshoe. I was on a top 10 run at Lenzerheide and unfortunately slid out on a gravel road 50 feet from the finish. You know, it's, you know, things happen. That's racing. But I think that I showed at the end of last year that I had found consistent speed, and I was there every weekend in, weekend out. At the end of the year, you know, I did try some things earlier in the season, and some races I just struggled at, like Leger. I just wasn't on pace, and there's nothing I can say, but I didn't have it that weekend, and I wasn't there with the pointy bit, the guys at the top. But yeah, it was a good year, and I'm happy with everything I did. You know, I wish that maybe I wouldn't have hit the deck so many times, but it's all a part of learning. And I think that that's all knowledge that I'm going to bring into this coming season, and it's going to help me for sure.
Yeah. Were there any specific things then? You say you were trying a few bits and pieces throughout the year. Is there anything that you found really worked well for you that you're going to keep?
Yeah. I guess it's being okay with, you know, whatever it is. I don't come out of the gate and just smash the first split. That's not who I am. That's not the racer. You know, I'm usually a second back or so, and I pull time back just because it takes me a little bit of time to build speed. I think the big thing that for me I learned was my warm up, my preparation for the race itself at the top. Okay. You know, you see, it's kind of a crazy place up there because you'll have some dudes that just sit against the wall with headphones on with their eyes closed. And then you have other dudes that are jumping around doing burpees, sprinting as hard as they can on the trainer. And that's what works for them. Like Baptiste Piron is about to rip the handlebars off his bike at the top. You know, he's so pumped up. And then there's other dudes that literally just sit there. And I think finding that level of intensity that leads to you having a good race run is really important to find your comfort. And for me at the top, you know, I start kind of medium hot. I spin around on the trainer. I stretch out, do a little dynamic warm up. But if I start like jumping around and doing sprints on the trainer, I'm probably not going to make it to the finish line because I'm going to get too pumped up, ride tight, and then crash. It's okay. It's just kind of what it works. And if I'm happy at the top, you know, for me, if I'm nervous and I'm quiet, it's usually I start thinking too much, my head turns on, and I can't perform. So it's kind of funny because me and my mechanic at the top, I think they know when it's going to be good and when it's not. When I'm nervous, they can tell, because, you know, when I'm joking around, cracking jokes, happy, smiling, it's usually a good day at the finish line. And if I'm up there quiet, sick to my stomach, I'm either off pace or I fall. So
interesting.
Bringing the intensity in which you bring into your run is really important, I think. And everyone else, you know, I've only raced for a few years here. It's not like I came through juniors and then I raced a few years in elite and I had time to figure all this out when I was, you know, racing juniors. Like a lot of these guys, I just wasn't a part of it then. So, you know, I you know, that race that I got 14th at Val d'Isole, I literally, like, everyone had trainers, everyone had, you know, mechanics, people going through their bike. And actually G. Atherton, his mechanic's like, "You all right, dude? You need anything?" Because I was literally just sitting against the wall, like standing there. Like I didn't, like, you know, I did a little dynamic, I stretched, swung my legs around a little bit, shook my hands off and got in the starting gate, essentially, you know. I didn't have a trainer at the top. And I did really good at that race. But, you know, looking back at it, you don't put the pieces to the puzzle together. You're just like, oh, I had a good run that weekend. And, you know, it's finding your formula that works for you, and everyone's different. And that's why you can look at so many, you know, racing techniques or tips or this and that, but you really have to find what works for you because everyone's different. Some dudes just come into the corner hot, skidding and slam it. Some dudes brake, set up wide, carry exit speed. You know, some dudes are doing burpees at the top and other guys are listening to Soundgarden, you know, and sitting in the corner away from it all. So it's just finding what works for you is, I think, really important.
Yeah, fair play. Yeah, and there's a lot of work in that, right, behind the scenes to find those things that work.
And there's only a few races a year that you actually, like, it's the real deal. Like, you have a room full of trainers, you have mechanics, you have all the pressure of the camera. I mean, you can really only find that out in that environment. I mean, me and Nico at the top warming up on our trainers here at Windrock, or, you know, at a local race, it's not the same environment. And there's, you know, only a couple races a year, and that learning, you know, sometimes comes at a high cost, because, you know, if you're out of it for a couple events, you're not there in the overall.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. All right. Well, you've had a big change this off season in bike setup. So you're now on Fox and Shimano.
Yep.
As opposed to the SRAM stuff from the last few years. How big of a deal is that? I imagine it's quite a lot of change.
Yeah, it's different for sure. Because I was a Fox Shimano guy on Morpheus in my first few years. So I've had and the Saint brakes haven't changed. So I've had quite a bit of time on, you know, these products in the past, but they've developed so much over the past few years. And, you know, things are always changing. Products, you know, are always developing at the highest level. So it's getting up to speed. It's still something that I remember and I've used in the past, but it's, you know, just a little bit different. So it's, for me, it's, you know, you're working with a whole new group of people, you're, you know, a whole new way of testing. And it's all new for the team as well. You know, they've, the dudes at Unior have always been on the SRAM stuff. So, for me, I felt like I had a little bit more of a fast track to getting you know, getting where I needed to be. And I got some help from the Fox guys. I mean, they got me in a good place right away, and I'm super comfortable with my bike setup. But it's always difficult changes, you know, the bike reacts differently and you're, you know, finding different balance in the frame these are products that really transform your whole bike. I'm fortunate enough to be on a Wilson, and I think there's no debate that that's a great bike and I'm super comfortable on it, but it's totally different than even what I was running last year. And I'm really happy with it. I'm really excited about it. And I think that, I have the help and the tools to really go out there and get some good results this season.
Awesome. And you've been out in Portugal. Was that the Fox test at Lucid?
Yep. So I went to the Fox test. And luckily I had a little bit of time, testing in California before we went out there for a week. Was in a good place when I went to Portugal, but you don't often get to test, you know, when you're testing on tracks that you've rode before and you're confident and up to speed, it doesn't always relate to a World Cup, because sometimes you can just make your bike too stiff because you could ride the track with your eyes closed. So you end up, you know, riding it at your local, and you have a background of knowledge of what, you know, multiple bikes have felt like there are multiple suspension setups and so on. But I think it's easy to make your bike too stiff until you get to one of these tracks that really is breaking bumps from top to bottom. The corners are blown up, and then you really can get a good sense of what the bike's going to feel like at the races. So we went towards the end of this Portugal test camp. I mean, we're a couple weeks out from the World Cup, so a lot of teams have been there. A lot of people have went and rode their test track there, and it really was a great track to set up the bike on. It was getting pretty rough by the time we were there. So, got to play with some different settings and run the timing system and kind of see what was working for me, what I felt most comfortable on. And, you know, there's still a lot of questions in my head about actually, you know, how to set up your bike for racing a World Cup. You know, do you make it real stiff and then the bike moves across the ground really fast, and then you end up doing more braking and trying to slow the bike down, but you're putting in less rider input? Do you run the bike a little softer so you... it doesn't maybe move across the ground as quick, and then you don't have to touch the brakes as much maybe, but you have to put more rider effort in to pump and keep the bike moving quickly. So it's like kind of answering some questions in my head and of what actually, you know, it's not like I'm Greg Minnaar and I've rode the bike for forever and I know exactly what to do to win races. That whole thing is still a question mark in our head. And I guess it's a question mark for everybody, right? That's the secret formula that everyone's trying to figure out of what makes you actually win a World Cup. But, these are things that I'm trying to find that make me, what makes me the most comfortable as a racer to perform on Sunday.
Yeah. Good stuff. And you're coming into 2020 with clean off season, no injuries.
Yeah. No, I'm healthy. So this is the first year that I really feel that I've had proper preparation. You know, I've had to work in the past, injuries, you know, like it's kind of always been rushed. And I started with my coach, after surgery last year. I started with Colin Izzard, and, we had a full, you know, last year we kind of got it together as quickly as we could. And I was, you know, in a good place last year, but this season I'm fitter than I've ever been, stronger than I've ever been. I'm healthy. You know, I still have, you know, lingering stuff that we're all working on, right? You know, we're athletes, nothing's ever perfect, but, I feel amazing on my bike. I'm in the best shape I've ever been. And really the first time that I feel like I'm prepared to go racing, and those boxes are checked to be at a level playing field with the other guys. You know, before it's always felt like I've been in a rush for time, or, you know, it's been forced, and we really, you know, planned it out. And even in the off season, like, you know, having him to just sit down and say, okay, like, this is your time frame. You have these weeks for this. And like, you need to have, you know, everything settled in your life, like, you know, all your off season tasks, you know, cause we race all summer. So, you know, you want to, you know, get the garage organized. You know, I built up my van in the fall to make, you know, the training a little nicer. You know, I have a place to put the muddy clothes, a place to hang up the muddy bike, you know, just to reduce friction within the training process. So I got all my off-season tasks done early and started training when I needed to, and everything's on board. And it's kind of an interesting season with the Olympics. So you have one race really early, one big block of racing, and then, you know, we have most of the summer off, and then you go racing again in the fall. And who knows what the weather is going to be like for those last few events. I think that's kind of maybe a question in everyone's head. But yeah, it's everything has come around, and trying not to get too excited too early for this first one because there's a lot of time. So maybe not fully revving on all cylinders for the first one, but I want to make sure that I'm ready to go for those two big blocks when it really counts.
Good stuff. Awesome. Looking forward to seeing how you get on, man. We're getting close to the end of our time, but we've got our four questions that we ask everyone. So we'll hit you up with those. First one of those, if our listeners had $200 roughly to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they go spend it on?
I think that just having a properly set up bike is really important. You know, a lot of the guys that come out to our bike park, you know, they don't get to ride downhill a lot. So their hands, you know, from a downhill aspect, because that's what I do, their hands get, you know, tired. So, and they, you know, they don't ride usually as much descending, because they maybe only ride on the weekends or ride, you know, a couple times a month, once a month, whatever. So they make the fork real soft, and then it packs in, and the rebound gets slower once they let air out, and they always feel like they're going to go over the bars. So they just, sometimes the bike would just feel a little better if they stiffened the fork up and got a good balance and held the bike up to its proper static geometry that the bike and suspension is made to perform at. So I think taking the time to maybe put a little bit of that money into having someone else help you set up your bike and get it operating in its, you know, the manner that it's intended to do is really important. And the second thing would just be, if maybe you've done that already, is just some good coaching. Have someone else follow you down a couple times and work you through how you can maybe descend a little bit more efficiently, you know, where to brake, where to let off the brakes, how to enter the corners, things like that actually, you know, break it down for you. So you have a something to go off of on a way to ride down the hill, you know, the things you're thinking about to make it a little bit easier. Because, you know, I go and ride with some of my friends, and at the speed I go, I don't really brake a lot, and I kind of skip over some of the stuff that's real challenging. But, you know, I'll go ride with James, and it's actually really hard to try to slow down that much. And just having somebody to work you through how to properly descend, I think is well worth the money, more than any bike part that's shiny you can put on.
Yeah, solid advice. I'd agree with both of those. All right, if you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give him? How old are you now?
27.
Okay, 16. Okay. Yeah.
For me, I think I would tell myself to just be willing to get kicked down and just continue to get up, no matter what it is in life that you work at. You know, my career is, you know, I put out a ton of videos and stuff talking about, you know, my story. And I've done that because no matter what it is that you want to be successful at, whether it's playing the piano, whether you want to be a bike racer, or whether you don't want to race F1 and you're in a go-kart and you're working your way through that sport or whatever it is, it's not going to be easy. And there's going to be a lot of times you're going to get kicked down, a lot of defeat. But if you're willing to work at it and be consistent for long enough, you can achieve anything you want to achieve. It's just be willing to put in the time to work at it for longer than most of the people around you are going to be willing to be consistent with it. And yeah, maybe get up and keep going when it's not so easy.
That is good advice. Yeah, nothing easy comes without a few setbacks on the way, right?
Yeah,
for sure. All right, third question. If you could have a coaching session with anyone, past or present, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them?
Sam Hill, how to turn when there is no turn. I watched that dude's videos and it honestly, he looks so sick on a bike and he will just stand up, chest up, and he will just literally turn his hips and the bike will turn and I don't know how, and it doesn't work for me like it does for him, I think. But he just, it's watching Sam Hill turn a bike is probably the sickest thing I've ever seen in my life. And I wish he could teach me that.
Excellent. It's amazing. Like, as a fan of the sport, who's not very fast on a bike, obviously I always say, yeah, it'd be great to have some coaching with Sam and learn that stuff. I've never expected to hear you guys say the same thing, but it feels like everyone is amazed at how he does it.
Yeah. It's, a lot of the times with racing, I feel like I'm falling down the hill looking for something to turn off of. And, you're always, looking for something to slam the bike into and make change directions and get where you need to be or whatever. But I mean, he wasn't looking for anything. He'd just say, I'm turning here and do it. And that's the coolest thing I think ever, is just having the confidence to just be like, and we're turning.
It's amazing, isn't it? Fair play to him. Cool. All right. Final question. What is something that you do every day that you feel benefits you?
Stretching. I think that just taking a few minutes in the morning to, I know we're all busy. We all are, grabbing coffee, rushing out the door, going to work, going to the gym, going to do this or that. But just for me, I try to make it a point every day to take a couple deep breaths, and just whether it's in the shower, whether it's, while you're waiting for the water to boil at the coffee machine or whatever, just take a few breaths and just stretch out a little bit. And I think it kind of relaxes me a lot. And I think we all just, our busy lifestyles, people are driving so much, traveling, sitting a lot. And if you really take the time to stretch out your body, I think that it'll improve your quality of life and everything that you do.
Yeah, I agree. I just never managed to actually get a habit. I can do it for a few days, but I've never done it for long enough to get the habit.
So. Yeah, I stretch in the shower. It's kind of weird, but I do it just a couple of things. Maybe it takes me 2 minutes, 3 minutes to just do a couple of things that are kind of nagging from me on the bike. Your shoulders pull in, your hips get real closed. And with warm water, it's, really relaxing. And I stretch my shoulders out and stretch my chest out and do some hamstrings and just little things. And I think it makes a big difference, on top of, obviously being athletes, we have a lot that we can do, but if you're playing hard, you gotta do it.
Fair play. All right. And if people want to follow you throughout the season, where's the best place for them to keep up to speed?
I post everything on my Instagram, at Dak Norton, try to keep all the updates there. And sometimes post gets a little long, but that's what I'm doing and that's what I'm up to. And more so than in the past, I'm trying to post a lot more stuff about, my life and what makes me happy, and not so much as much about hey, I'm here at this race, here's another photo of me riding my bike, but things that I'm really enjoying, riding my dirt bike, going to coffee shops, doing the things that make me who I am. So if you want to follow what I'm up to in my season and it's all up there.
Awesome. Good stuff, man. Well, it's been super interesting chatting, and I'm excited for the 2020 season and to see how you get on, man. Full form, fit, strong, ready to go.
Yeah. Excited for it. Hopefully we'll have a good one.
Good stuff. Thanks. Cheers for coming on, man.
Yeah. Cheers. Thank you.
All right, that's it for this episode with Dakota. I hope you've enjoyed listening. Big thank you to We Are One Composites for their support. Don't forget that as a Downtime listener, you can get 15% off their stock wheels and the depackaged bar and stem until the end of April by using the code HANDLAID2020. That's HANDLAID2020, all in lowercase, at the checkout on weareonecomposites.com. Head there now and check out what they've got to offer. Thank you to everyone who's donated to help keep the podcast going over the last couple of months. If you're enjoying what I'm doing, then you can still donate, or you can get hold of some of our exclusive Downtime merch over at downtimepodcast.com/shop. If you've got a couple of minutes, then please leave us a review wherever it is you listen to the podcast. Give us a follow on social media where we're at Downtime Podcast. Make sure you subscribe to the show so you get all of our episodes delivered straight to your device. And if you want to help support the podcast, then you know what to do. You can share the love at downtimepodcast.com/shop. Also, please keep on spreading the word, telling your friends about the podcast and sharing our episodes on your social media. It all helps a lot. All right, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon, but until then, look after each other, and if it's okay to do so, then get out and ride safely.